What happens when a Smith College graduate with a comfortable life finds herself wearing prison khakis and an inmate number? Piper Kerman's memoir isn't your typical prison story. It's a searing examination of America's broken justice system through the eyes of someone who never expected to end up there. After a youthful dalliance with international drug smuggling came back to haunt her a decade later, Kerman spent 13 months in federal prison. Her story became a cultural phenomenon, spending over a year on bestseller lists and inspiring a groundbreaking Netflix series. But beneath the intrigue lies something more urgent, a firsthand account of how America punishes its citizens, who gets caught in the net, and why the system fails almost everyone it touches. This isn't just Kerman's story. It's a mirror held up to a nation that incarcerates more people than any other country on earth. Fresh out of Smith College, Kerman chose adventure over convention with Nora Jansen, a raspy-voiced woman working for West African drug kingpin Alaji. Kerman was captivated by the dangerous lifestyle, exotic travel, and freedom from rules. In Bali, she enjoyed hedonistic pleasures, while Nora made tense calls with criminal contacts. Alaji offered contracts for drug-filled suitcases that subcontractors transported into the United States. Kerman gradually became involved, retrieving money wires and eventually carrying cash to Brussels. Witnessing stark poverty in Jakarta, including a legless beggar she tried to help, disturbed her. When Nora asked her to carry drugs, Kerman realized she was only valued for money-making. Though her family would have rescued her with one call, she never reached out. Fortunately, the drugs never arrived. Kerman fled to San Francisco, vowing never to lose herself again. She rebuilt her life through multiple jobs, eventually becoming a TV producer and meeting Larry, her reliable partner. Their happiness shattered in May 1998 when U.S. Customs officers appeared with an indictment nearly a decade after her crime. Kerman's ex-lover's drug operation collapsed, with Nora naming names to save herself. Facing mandatory minimum sentencing policies that had ballooned America's prison population by 300% since the 1980s, Kerman pleaded guilty to money laundering and received a 30-month sentence. The kingpin Alaji's arrest in London postponed her imprisonment for nearly 6 years during extradition proceedings. She lived under federal supervision, keeping her situation secret while Larry's unwavering support sustained her. When he proposed with 7 thin gold rings, one for each year together, her joy was tempered by dread of telling his parents, who surprised her with compassion. Eventually, the U.S. attorney moved forward. Kerman received 15 months at the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. On February 4, 2004, Larry drove her to prison. Their goodbye was heartbreaking. Inside, Kerman faced dehumanizing intake, cavity search, confiscated clothes, prison khakis. Her new identity was stamped on a red card with registration number 11187424. She was no longer Piper Kerman. She was federal property. Kerman arrived at the camp, a minimum security facility resembling a 1970s elementary school. Small kindnesses sustained her, women checking on her, roommates like Annette and Miss Luz, a tiny elderly woman recovering from breast cancer. She quickly learned rigid routines, count times, 4:30 p.m. supper time, strict dining hall hierarchy. As a new arrival with A&O status, she couldn't work or attend classes, only read books and use writing supplies gifted by other prisoners. Larry's Friday visits became precious lifelines. Racial segregation was unabashed. Dorms openly called the suburbs, the ghetto, and Spanish Harlem. After 2 weeks, Kerman moved to B dorm with Natalie Malcolm, a petite Caribbean woman and head baker nearing the end of an 8-year sentence. Natalie proved the perfect bunkie, dignified, quiet, full of prison wisdom. Kerman was assigned to the electric shop, learning the hardest physical labor of her life, valuing the job for its normalcy despite an unpleasant supervisor. 5 months in, Kerman had mastered prison survival, cleaning with maxi pads, wiring light fixtures, recognizing relationships, knowing when to curse in Spanish. Prison cooking was a marvel of ingenuity. The two communal microwaves produced remarkable creations from homesick Spanish and West Indian women. Corn chips transformed into chilaquiles, while contraband onions became precious commodities. These meals, unlike institutional food, smelled of love and care. Mother's Day revealed elaborate social structures. Many women crocheted red roses for their prison mamas, formalized family relationships, providing advice, food, and discipline. The visiting room revealed prison's extremes. Mothers lit up playing with children, only to face gut-wrenching goodbyes. Women watched babies become toddlers, missing championships, proms, graduations, weddings. Most women at Danbury were nonviolent drug offenders from poor backgrounds, where narcotics offered the only viable employment. They received harsh sentences for low-level dealing, especially with overworked court-appointed lawyers. Kerman recognized her privilege, her fantastic private attorney and country club suit. Though she'd viewed drug laws as intellectually bankrupt, seeing addiction's devastating impact made her understand her own complicity through relationships with those harmed by the drug trade. Children's Day brought rare normalcy as inmates spent time with their kids. Kerman volunteered for face painting, watching activities like piñatas and cookouts that ended with heartbreaking goodbyes. The concentrated happiness left her crying afterward. Big Boo invited her to Jay's birthday party, where colorful characters played rhyming reels, moments providing essential respite. Kerman eventually joined Yoga Janet's class, finding peace despite makeshift conditions. When Miss Mahoney announced GED test results, the prison erupted in celebration. Kerman's bunkie, Natalie, had taken the test a dozen times, struggling with math. Without her GED, she couldn't earn more than 14 cents an hour, despite skilled baking. These diplomas opened doors to slightly better wages. The cruel paradox became clear. Surviving lengthy sentences required accepting prison as their universe, but this institutionalization would make outside survival nearly impossible upon release. With release approaching after 13 months, Kerman received a letter saying she might testify against a co-defendant in Chicago. Suddenly ordered to pack out, she endured a degrading Con Air journey. Shackled with chains around her waist, handcuffs attached, ankle cuffs with a foot of chain between them. The massive 747 was packed with male prisoners greeting women with catcalls. The Chicago Metropolitan Correctional Center was far worse than Danbury, a triangular fortress resembling a psychiatric ward with blaring TVs, disheveled women, and chaos. Cut off from her support system, Kerman felt her stability wavering. Kerman's final week proved hardest. Unlike Danbury, where she would have received a boisterous send-off, in Chicago, she felt terribly alone. Finally, on March 4, the guard called Kerman, pack out. The prison provided ill-fitting men's clothes, $28.30, and released her through a service entrance. She saw Larry waiting and ran to him. No one could stop her now. Throughout her life, Kerman had believed in fundamental solitude. Prison should have reinforced this, but taught her the opposite. The people who wrote, visited, and traveled long distances showed she wasn't forgotten. Most importantly, her fellow inmates helped her recognize what they shared. Overcrowded dorms, lack of privacy, prison khakis, cheap food, but also humor, creativity in adversity, and determination to protect their humanity. Small kindnesses proved she wasn't alone. Kerman's memoir reveals profound inequities in justice. While she, a white, well-educated woman from privilege, received 13 months in minimum security, many fellow inmates, predominantly women of color from disadvantaged backgrounds, faced much harsher punishments for similar or lesser crimes. Through honest portrayal of prison life, the small dignities preserved, unexpected friendships formed, resilience shown, Kerman reminds us that those behind bars remain human beings deserving compassion and second chances. Her story challenges us to imagine a more just system focused on rehabilitation rather than punishment.